Well, it's a beautiful Friday afternoon, and so we doubly and triply appreciate your joining us this afternoon and being part of what's a larger workshop on the issue of Sino-American rapprochement in the Cold War. I'm Jim Goldgeier from the Elliott School of International Affairs, and along with my colleagues Hope Harrison and Jim Hirschberg, we co-direct, co-run the George Washington University Cold War Group, GWCW, and we're delighted to have you here as part of this GWCW event. In addition to this, we have our monthly brown bag seminar on Cold War topics, ongoing research, recently published books. We have our annual graduate student conference later this spring. Any of you interested in the graduate student conference, proposals are due in a week. Any of you interested in the brown bag seminar, you're more than welcome to pass us your name and we'll put you on our list. We have been very fortunate with GWCW to have received a grant from the Luce Foundation to build up our programs on major topics on the Cold War in Asia. And in addition to all that's going on in the History Department and other departments teaching undergraduate and graduate courses, we're also developing other events and programs like this to try to shed light on important topics of the Cold War in Asia, and in particular trying to have folks come together who've been working with documents, new evidence, new interpretations of old events from very different perspectives. And in this case, in the case of our effort on this subject, American, Chinese, as well as other sources of information. I'm going to leave the introductions of this particular event to our moderator, but I do want to say, in introducing him, that Harry Harding, who has been dean of the Elliott School, I guess since 1995, has done an extraordinary job in developing all sorts of programs at the Elliott School. But the one that I'm most appreciative of his helping to develop is this GWCW. His support for our efforts has been extraordinary. We're very grateful to him for it. And it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to him for this afternoon's event. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to join Jim Goldgeier in expressing a very warm welcome to all of you. I, too, am amazed and pleased and gratified that so many of you would be with us today on a very beautiful Friday afternoon. But I think that the discussion here is what attracted you and is going to be well worth it. I'm particularly excited about this event and this day and this conference for a number of reasons. First of all, I am myself an amateur Cold War historian, having written a book about U.S.-China relations for two decades of the Cold War, from 1972 to 1992. I obviously am fascinated by the topic of this weekend's conference, the 30th anniversary of the Nixon visit to China. But I'm also even more fascinated by the international Cold War history enterprise. This is very exciting in two interconnected ways. First of all, the scholars assembled here are indeed writing international history. That is, they are looking at major events from a variety of different perspectives. In this case, as you'll see, not just from the American and the Chinese, but also from the Vietnamese, from the Russian, and other national perspectives as well. And secondly, in doing this, they are taking advantage of the greater availability of archival resources and, in some cases, interview resources from all of, or at least many of, the participants in the Cold War. One of the most fascinating bits of material that we got from, not a bit, pieces of material, piles of material, you can see some of it over there, is a series of declassified and, in some cases, translated materials, especially from the U.S. side, but also to a degree from the Chinese side, and we understand we'll be getting some tomorrow from the Soviet and Eastern European side, that is shedding new light on the facts of the period from 1969 through 1972 that we are discussing here. And of course, one of the fascinating issues is to what extent this changes interpretations of the international history of the Cold War, to what extent does it introduce new facts, or in some cases, simply to what extent does it provide fascinating, illustrative details. I'm secondly very proud because of the fact that this is a project that I think GW is playing a very, very major role in. Partly by chance and then increasingly by design, we are becoming a center internationally in the international study of the Cold War. This is not only because of the faculty, most of whom Jim mentioned in his opening remarks, but also our partnerships. We take advantage first of our very close relations with the National Security Archive in Gelman Library, which is the world's leading center for and repository of declassified materials, especially from the United States, but other sources as well. We also have a very close and long-standing connection with the Cold War International History Project at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And that trilateral, triangular, strategic triangle, let's call it, on international Cold War history among those three organizations is really at the heart of what we do. Increasingly, however, we are looking abroad. International history should be conducted internationally, and we are forging partnerships with both the London School of Economics and the University of Hong Kong, which are also major centers for the study of the Cold War, and we hope to have exchanges of both students and faculty with those partner institutions in the very near future. And finally, we have a partnership with the Luce Foundation. I want to extend my thanks, as well as Jim's, to the Luce Foundation for their support of this particular venture. And finally, I'm pleased because I think that this is a good example of what universities can contribute to the Washington policy community. What is our niche? Obviously, we train students. That's a very important task. But in terms of outreach, what we can do is to provide a much deeper immersion in both history and theory than our sister think tanks around Washington, for whom history is often what happened last week, not what happened last century, and for whom theory is the latest concept they heard at last week's cocktail party in Georgetown. Universities are able to devote considerable resources to basic research in history and in the social sciences. And yet, as a professional school of international affairs, we then are able to help bridge the gap between theory and practice and to show how history, in this case, is very relevant to an understanding of contemporary affairs. Without further ado, let us turn to our discussion this afternoon. As you know, we now have a little less than 2 hours together. We're going to ask all three of our speakers to come up at the podium and make some opening remarks for about 10 minutes each, and then we will have an open discussion among ourselves and especially with you, the audience. Let me introduce our three speakers and then say a few words about the emphases that they probably will begin with. And let me begin, in each case, by reminding you of their role at the time of the planning and the undertaking of the Nixon visit to China. In those years, our first speaker, Winston Lord, was special assistant to the National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, and therefore was centrally involved in Kissinger's secret visit to China in 1971, and then in the visit by President Nixon in 1972, as well as many other visits by both Dr. Kissinger and President Ford. In subsequent years, he served variously as director of the policy planning staff in the State Department, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, as ambassador to Beijing, and then as assistant secretary of state for East Asia Pacific Affairs. He is now the co-chairman of the International Rescue Committee. The second speaker will be William Smizer, better known to everyone as Dick. At that time, he was also on the National Security Council staff. He was a senior official for Asia with a particular focus on Vietnam. If you read the Kissinger memoir, he's always referred to as my Vietnam expert, Dick Smizer. Since leaving government, he has done, and I did not know this, Dick, a lot of work in intergovernmental organizations. He served as Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees in the United Nations and as Assistant Secretary General of the UN. He also served as Director of the U.S. State Department's own refugee program. He is presently teaching and lecturing at Georgetown, the U.S. Foreign Service Institute, and other institutions, and also is a prolific writer as well. Our third speaker is Helmut Sonnenfeld, known by his friends as Hal. Hal, in the late 1960s and early 70s, was a senior staff member of the National Security Council with a particular focus on the then Soviet Union. After leaving that capacity in 1974, he served as counselor of the State Department, and he has been for many years a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution, working on foreign and defense policies. At present, he is also a trustee of the Johns Hopkins University, a member of the Defense Policy Board, and the executive panel for the Chief of Naval Operations. Although I don't mean to restrict what they're going to say, I think that our three colleagues are going to begin by looking at three of the aspects of the trip that we have been discussing in our meetings earlier today. Wynn is going to look at the overall calculations, the overall thinking on the part of the Nixon administration, and he may focus, if he so chooses, I'm sure he will be asked to later, if he doesn't so choose initially, to say a few words about the role of Taiwan in American thinking and how the Taiwan issue was handled on that trip. Dick Smizer, obviously given his background, will probably speak to the question of the way in which the strategy behind the visit was aimed at dealing with America's involvement in Vietnam, how the Vietnam issue was approached by both the American side and by the Chinese, and how Sonnenfeld will talk about the impact, both planned and actual, on U.S. relations with the Soviet Union, the origins and evolution of the so-called strategic triangle. They obviously will be bringing together in unique combinations their own personal experiences and memories from the time, but also shaped by the memories that perhaps have been jogged or even new information provided by this wealth of fascinating documentation that the GW Cold War Group and the National Security Archive have provided us. Wynn, please start off.
Thank you, Harry. It's both a professional and personal pleasure to be here. Professional because you look at the historical context. As noted, it's almost exactly 30 years to Nixon's arrival in China. And I would also note that President Bush will be arriving exactly on February 21, the 30th anniversary. Personally, it's a pleasure to see not only my colleagues here to my right, but I'll call them by their first names because their last names have been changing, but Diane and Julie Pinot and Diane Matthews and Julie Pinot, who also were very heavily involved in the NSC in that period. And a note of poignancy and sadness, I wish John Holdridge could be with us today. He was with Dick and me on the first secret trip and, of course, was crucial to the China opening. I was fortunate to be involved in all three of the events that climaxed in 72, the opening of China, detente with the Russians, peace in Vietnam. In the case of Vietnam, I worked with Dick. In the case of Russia, I was clearly in a supporting, spear-carrying role to Hal Sonnenfeld and Bill Hyland, but I did manage to get involved in all three of these. Now, we have looked at these exhaustive files today, and I'm struck not only how exhausting it was to take all these notes and do all this work, but we had a very clever classification to make it so sensitive. It was top secret, sensitive, exclusively eyes only, which is an absurd appellation, it seems to me. If it's top secret, it's already sensitive. And I don't know what exclusively eyes only is supposed to mean. I mean, don't read it with your feet or what. I haven't figured any of that out. In any event, I only have 10 minutes. I'll speak at New York speed. I'll give you brush strokes since it is China, and we can fill in the gaps later because I want to touch on the pre-secret trip and then the secret trip and then the Nixon trip and just a few highlights. Nixon sent a memo 1 week after his inauguration to Kissinger saying, let's get in touch with the Chinese. It was a very high priority. Soviet dimension was number one. Help on ending the Indochina War was there, but not as crucial as the Soviet dimension. Generally speaking to the communist bloc through many voices, including Eastern Europe and not just Moscow, monopolizing it, and general stability in Asia, diplomatic flexibility, were our main reasons. China was worried about the Soviet threat. China wanted to come out of its Cultural Revolution isolation diplomatically, and they knew if they opened with us, that it would lead the door to the UN, to opening with Japan and rest of Europe, etc. Now, the first challenge that the president the Kissinger faces, how do you get in touch with and how do you signal someone you've been hostile toward and mutually isolated from for 20 years? And so therefore, again, in brushstrokes, we went through various channels to reach the Chinese and convey our intentions of a new relationship, French, Romanian, some others, and we settled on the Pakistani channel. And secondly, to take public steps, unilateral, which the Chinese didn't have to reciprocate, but which would make a clear signal to them and to other interested countries if they're paying attention that we were shifting our China policy. So we unilaterally relaxed trade and travel restrictions. We called China by its official name. We did other subtle things like that. And the Chinese began to do the same in return, releasing some American yachtsmen who were captured, and of course then the famous ping pong American team visit in April 71. And from the very beginning, and it's still true today, the big sensitive issue, the big hurdle to move ahead was Taiwan. We can come back to that. But we didn't settle on the secret trip until April 71, until we finally got through the Pakistani channel from the Chinese, Zhou Enlai, that they were willing to talk about Taiwan plus other areas of interest to both sides. Until then, they hung tough and said, we only talk and settle Taiwan, then we can go on. We refused to go on that basis. So that was the problem from the beginning. Secret trip, some of my colleagues have heard this ad nauseum, but I do have to point out that not only was Nixon not the first one into China, Kissinger wasn't either. I was the first one into China. And you think I'm kidding, but what happened was when a Pakistani plane flying secretly from Islamabad to Beijing, Smizer and I were sitting in the front, and I made sure that Kissinger called him to the back of the plane, so that as we reached Chinese territory, namely the border, right after going by K2, as the plane went into Chinese airspace, I was the first American to China. And Smizer and Kissinger were tied for second in the back of the plane. Now, the big issue on the plane was not how do we deal with Zhou Enlai, the James Bond aspects of this trip, because it was secret, obviously, the geopolitical earthquake we were now beginning. It was the fact that Kissinger had no shirts on the plane. His assistant forgot to pack any shirts. And he was really upset about that. That's all he talked about, essentially. And I, of course, pointed out to Henry that he hasn't even negotiated with Zhou Enlai yet. He's already lost his shirt. He borrowed one from John Holdridge, who was about 6'4", who went around looking like a penguin. And then we looked at the collar of the shirt and said, made in Taiwan. So the big issue on the secret trip was to divide the community, first to have substantive discussions to see whether we had enough to go ahead with the relationship and how we're going to put Taiwan in a modus vivendi operation so that we, because it was too sensitive to solve, but do enough so we can move ahead with the Soviet threat and other geopolitical dimensions. And that's, therefore, we had two issues in devising the very brief announcement of Kissinger's secret trip that Nixon made in July 15 in San Clemente a few days later. And the first was, were they inviting Nixon or was he asking to go? And we finally got around that saying, knowing of Nixon's desire to visit China, the Chinese invite him. So it was sort of mutual. And then secondly, we got in there that we talked not only about normalization, code word for Taiwan, but also other issues. As I said, we had to get over that hurdle. But it was a long, tense, overnight drafting of a very short, dramatic communique. The other interesting thing I won't have time to go into was but an exposition by Zhou Enlai over Peking Duck Lunch about the Cultural Revolution. Then we had an October public trip to set up three things for the Nixon trip coming in February 72. One was the sort of the public figuring out where he's going to, what sites he was going to visit and go through all that, accustom the Chinese people to these demons who are coming from America that have been vilified for 20 years. And we did all that in the press and security arrangements. Secondly, further substantive discussions to set up the agenda for Nixon's visit. And thirdly, beginning to draft the Shanghai communique. Now, here was very interesting that it's clear that Mao was calling the shots here. Zhou Enlai, however skillful, charismatic, was carrying out his orders. Because we gave them a draft communique that basically said we love each other despite the last 22 years. Joe says he'd take a look at it. He comes back the next day, throws it on the floor essentially, and says, I've talked to the chairman, and in fact, and we're sure he did. This is absurd. After 22 years, of course we don't love each other, and we're going to make our allies nervous if we phrase it that way. Why don't we each state our own positions, ideologically and on the key issues? Then we'll have credibility where we can agree in the other parts of the communique, and we'll reassure nervous friends that we haven't sold them out. So that was the most interesting part of that. We got all the Shanghai communique done essentially, except the Taiwan issue, which is a little bit like Mrs. Lincoln in the play. But still, we got the rest of it done, and we finished that on the President's trip. How much time have I got? I'm going rather fast. Okay. So we're up to the President's trip. And here I want to make the point that Nixon really does deserve great credit, not only for the opening of China generally, but his performance in getting ready for that trip. I was in overall charge of assembling the brief, of course, because John Holdridge was central to this, and the State Department by now is fully involved in CIA and so on. We prepared 6 books about this big, everything from talking points to transcripts of past conversations to Mao histories and poetry and philosophy. Nixon read literally every page. He was marking things up and still asking for more memos as we flew to Guam and Hawaii on the way to China. So he did an extraordinary amount of work, showed how good he was before being preoccupied with Watergate and how good he was in foreign policy. And then he performed extremely well in the Mao and Zhou meetings. And as some of you may know, I was in the Mao meeting with Kissinger and Nixon. I can give you the reason why you didn't know that, and then I was out of the pictures and out of the communique after that meeting. I'll just leave you hanging with anticipation there. But it was a very exciting, of course, to be in that meeting, although it was frustrating not to tell anyone except my wife. And I'll end on this note. All of this is especially dramatic for me because I was born to someone. I was married to someone who was born in Shanghai. And so being the first American there with an American wife. And so the issue was, before we went on the secret trip, you know, how could I let her know, despite the fact it was so sensitive? Because I told her everything. I mean, I was in the Vietnam negotiations with Dick. We spent 13 weekends in Paris. I had to explain that somehow. And so I figured out a way to do this. Henry had told me, look, I know you tell Betty everything, but in this one, this is too sensitive, because her father works indirectly for Taiwan. All her relatives are on the mainland. And if there's a leak, the paranoid Nixon White House is going to figure your wife did it. And so I had to promise Henry I wouldn't tell her. So the way I resolved this was I went to the window the night before we left on the trip, which was public except for the China dimension. And I called her to the window, and I pointed out in the darkness into the trees and said, look, I think I see out there a Peking Tom. And I left it at that. I never told her where I was going, but she was smart enough to figure that one out. And so that's how I square that circle. But we'll square some more circles in the discussion. Sorry to go so fast, but we do want to get to your questions and comments. Thank you.
I had been alerted that there would be a certain amount of character assassination and destruction here, so I want to call your attention to something else.
And very few people here will recognize this, but Winston Lord will. This is a photo album that Joe and I gave to the 4 members of the American delegation, Henry, Winston, John, and myself, as we left Peking, Beijing as they now call it. It was the most classified document in the world. Because I can never do these things right. Of this photograph, which incidentally those of you with keen eyes will recognize that Henry Kissinger has a very prominent color. I leave this here for you to examine. And this is what Winston Lord did to me. Not only did he go first into China, leaving me sitting in the back, but also, actually, I was the person who introduced Kissinger to Zhou Enlai in this photo. I was in the back, and they blacked me out. And I want the record to show. I also want the record to show, of course, that my last book was called From Yalta to Berlin. It's on Germany. It is used by Professor Hope Harrison in a brilliant course. She has asked me to announce that those of you who are in that course, who are here today, get credit for next week's course by being here and don't need to attend.
I did not say that.
They have to buy your book, right?
Well, they definitely have to buy that. They have to buy that anyway. If you have it here, I'll autograph it. In any case, actually the main reason I stayed where I was on the plane was because I was talking to a very interesting person who was Mao's niece. And what was fascinating about that was that Mao sending his niece off to meet us in Islamabad and escort us, so to speak, into Peking or Beijing was a sign, really, of the royal blessing. This was roughly like having the Prince of Wales or somebody like that. She was not in the government. But nonetheless, the very fact that this was Mao's niece was something that was very important. My conversation with her, I should tell you, was not one of the most profound conversations of my life. We talked a little bit, and at one point I asked her, you know, I said, if we have an opening, maybe you can come to the United States sometime. And we have the Grand Canyon, and we have New York City, and we have Yosemite, and so on. So I think you'd like to see all those things. And she looked at me straight, and she said, I'm sure there will be an interesting program made for me. So this gives you some idea of what we were called. But we had a purpose on Vietnam in going to China. And it was a purpose that emerges from this book. There was a time when you could not attend a party in Georgetown without this book. I don't know now whether any of you will even recognize it, anybody under the age of 25. It's the Chairman Mao's sayings of the Chairman Mao Zedong, and it is called the Little Red Book. And there was a time when you would get photos of 200,000 people standing in Red Square showing this Little Red Book, because everything in here was true. And one of the things that was true in here was, of course, that the richest source to wage war is the masses of the people. This was the doctrine of people's war. It was the doctrine that Mao had sponsored, and it was the doctrine that Lin Piao wrote in his book. And it was a doctrine that was being dramatically misproved in Vietnam. In Vietnam, we had no such thing as smart bombs. I can tell you, if we had had smart bombs, we would have won the war, which shows you, interestingly, how little technical things make an enormous difference. And the reason we would have won the war is because we could have blocked the roads and the bridges and the convoys and everything, which we couldn't do. What happened instead was that there were these miserable little bridges in North Vietnam, you remember this, which all these convoys were running across, and we sent our poor pilots in to try to knock out those bridges. And there's only one way to knock out a bridge, and that is to fly straight along it. You cannot do it by flying across it. You have to fly straight along it and hope to God that your bombs go straight along. Most of the time, of course, they didn't. The Russians gave the North Vietnamese, as we then called them, the largest bunch of AK-AK batteries you've ever seen, as well as missiles, and our pilots were being shot at. You know, it was the kind of thing that you get if you go to a little weekend fair, bang, 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 bang. We were losing pilots, we were losing planes. And more important, the Russians who were furnishing these weapons were gaining influence in Hanoi. And so we looked at this, and Kissinger and I discussed it, and we said what we really have to do is make clear to the Chinese that they have got to stop playing the game of people's war, and they've got to be prepared to let the war end. Up until then, they had been going around encouraging the Vietnamese to keep fighting, because they were fighting people's war. And so we had to say to them, in essence, look, there is a way to end the war, and that is to negotiate. And we thought that they would be sufficiently interested in ending the war through negotiations, because ending the war meant a significant reduction in Soviet influence over Hanoi. After all, the North Vietnamese would no longer need as many Russian weapons. They wouldn't need to fire all this stuff all the time. Mind you, they had other things from the Russians and the anti-aircraft. But nonetheless, it was these weapons that were the beaten weapons. So we decided that the thing to do was for Kissinger to make the argument to Zhou Enlai, saying essentially, look, there are two ways to end this war. One is to let it go on, and after a while, there'll be some kind of military solution. And then it'll end the way all wars end, which is slowly but surely people just decide to stop fighting. Or it can be ended by negotiations, and that way is quicker. And we felt that the Chinese had an interest in ending it. And essentially what happened was that you could get out of what the Chinese said and of what Zhou Enlai said, a recognition before the meetings were over that this was something he realized.
Zhou Enlai, as all of you know, leads the kind of life, or led the kind of life, of an Italian opera singer, which is that he never went to sleep until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, never got up before 10 or 11. We certainly didn't meet with him in the early morning. And indeed, at night, he would look at things and think about them, and often, late in the evening, he would also talk to Mao. So essentially, what Kissinger did was to use a combination of warning and temptation, saying, if there's no peace, the war will go on. If there is peace, the war will end. He said that in the first meeting. He said that in the second meeting. Curiously enough, we learned in the second meeting, when Kissinger briefed Zhou Enlai about the most recent proposals that we had had in the secret talks in Paris, that the Vietnamese were not briefing the Chinese about those secret talks, which was kind of interesting in itself. But time after time, Kissinger, not time after time, but still several times, Kissinger delivered this message. And the interesting thing was the change in Zhou Enlai's messages. The first were very tough. We have nothing to do. You've got to get out. You've got to get rid of Chu. You've got to do, and he sort of provided the standard list. Now, either because he got tired, which is unlikely, or because he began to realize that maybe there were things that he should think about a little bit more, his messages changed as the conversations went on, so that by the morning and the afternoon that we left, which, as you remember, was under this deadline that we had to get out before we lost our window over Tehran, because the plane had to get to Paris by a certain day. In those things, Zhou Enlai began saying, instead of saying, you've got to get rid of Chu, he said, oh, okay, they will collapse of their own accord. Then he said, even more interestingly, Taiwan is the only issue between us, which is essentially his way of distancing himself from the whole Vietnam discussion. Then he said, of course, we support them, but they can decide things for themselves. Now, these were not new formulations in themselves, but coming in the context in which we had posed the issue, I thought they were quite remarkable. And at the end, he said, we will be happy if you are able to solve this question. When Kissinger came back to Washington, Winston and I worked on a memo from him to the president, in which we said that we thought that Zhou Enlai's reaction to the Vietnam issue over the period of the talks had been one of the more interesting accomplishments of the visit. So I mentioned that to show that there was more to this visit than pretty photos and China and Taiwan, but also that we feel that we made some headway in getting the Chinese to recognize that long-term people's war was perhaps not the answer. Now, we knew we would never get them actually to say to the Vietnamese, you've got to accept the American position. That was beyond the pale, and we didn't expect that. But what we hoped for, and what ultimately happened, was that the Chinese backed off on their constant rhetoric to the Vietnamese, saying, under no circumstances can you make a political settlement. And that was really all that we had hoped to get. Thank you.
Appreciate that the sinologists here are letting a barbarian join the crowd, since I'm not of that particular professional persuasion. I appreciate the many comments that my colleagues have made that I wanted to make. I am a little bit at a disadvantage, in addition to not being a sinologist, that while history is a great hobby of mine, I have not yet gotten to all the stuff that's being declassified and published by all sorts of governments, including ours and to some extent the Chinese and the Russians and so on, because I'm involved in a project that deals with the use of back channels and circumvention of secretaries of state in American diplomatic history. And I have just finished the the part dealing with George Washington, who instead of using his Secretary of State, Mr. Jefferson, used the Chief Justice of the United States, Mr. Jay, to negotiate a very important treaty with the British to follow on the peace treaty. He didn't trust Jefferson, or Jefferson wasn't trusted because he was considered a Francophile. So John Jay did the work, and Mr. Jefferson went back to Monticello to wait for his return. John Adams, it's now become general knowledge because there's a best-selling biography, but for a while I was the only one that knew it. When John Adams decided that his son, John Quincy, would be of better service to him if he were stationed in Berlin as the American minister, rather than in Lisbon, where he was going to go, wrote him a letter, his son, and told him that I'm sending you to Berlin, don't feel awkward or embarrassed about it, nobody will say that this is because I'm your father. I'm sending you there because I need eyes and ears, and that will know that they must report to me candidly, but to state cautiously. That was his basic instruction to John Quincy Adams, and it carried on through the whole century and just about to this day. So I hadn't gotten to this huge stack of stuff that's been on the table in our workshop here, but eventually I will. It was a long march from 1949 and 1950 when the Chinese came streaming over the Yalu to our surprise. It was a long march from then to 20 years later when Nixon became president and had already decided, because he published an article about it in Foreign Affairs shortly before he was inaugurated, decided that our situation in regard to the Vietnam War, our relationship with the Soviet Union, the public unrest, uneasiness, to put it mildly, here in America, required more mobility in American foreign relations. The matter of the Russian or the Soviet-Chinese relationship had long been a controversial one among the experts in our government and to some extent in the even in the scholarly community. There were many people who said that the dispute and conflict and tension and friction between the Soviet Union and China was a sham to lure us into some missteps and confuse us. There were some who said they were both Marxist-Leninists and people of that persuasion. Ultimately, whatever little differences they might have will remain together. That was not the history of Trotsky and a whole bunch of other people in the 1930s who had differences with the Bolshevik leadership. In fact, the Bolsheviks were among the most, whatever you want to call it, disputatious among each other, despite their common philosophy, because they couldn't agree on what the philosophy was, among other things, and they were also power hungry. And it was virtually impossible to get anyone in a political position, partly because of the history in 49, who lost China, which seemed more important than what that actually meant in domestic politics, and because of the experience in Korea. It was virtually impossible for an American politician to suggest that it was not wise to leave a huge a population in Asia, where we obviously had long and profound interests, without any kind of relationship between us. That was the third rail of American politics. Nixon was one of the very few politicians, and as a known anti-communist,
probably more capable of opening things up than anyone else would have been or might have been. But in the beginning of the Nixon administration, this need for greater room for maneuver produced two virtually parallel courses of our foreign policy. One was to pick up threads for the Soviet Union, which had more or less come apart or had been shoved aside because of the invasion of Czechoslovakia in August of 1968, and it was simply not something that you could do in polite company to deal in any sort of intimate way with the Soviets. The summit meeting had actually been scheduled in the very same period of the invasion of Czechoslovakia between Lyndon Johnson and the Soviet leaders. The start of strategic arms limitation talks had been scheduled. A non-proliferation treaty, which some people consider to be extraordinarily important, had been negotiated, and it was required ratification, but it was held up because of Czechoslovakia. So we were pretty well stuck from the summer of 1968 on into the start of the Nixon administration. The Soviets apparently felt this also because their very agile ambassador here during the transition, from Johnson to Nixon, had come in to suggest that certain words should be included in the president's inaugural address, which the Soviets would recognize were words that they had suggested and which might reopen channels of communication between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. They obviously were looking for ways to get out of the doghouse, despite the fact that they were generally regarded as being our main and maybe the most deadly challenger. Nixon and Kissinger both felt at the start of the new administration that it was time to open up some channels with the Soviets, and it's actually quite interesting how early in the administration the notion of a summit meeting, the one that had to be canceled, crept into the conversation between Kissinger and Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador, without anyone elsewhere in the administration and knowing about it. It was really the start of a back channel with the Soviets very early in that administration. Simultaneously, some gentle moves were made to signal to the Chinese that there might be some possibilities for movement in American policy. And neither the Chinese were fully informed about, or maybe not at all informed, about the communications back and forth which became more and more intense between the White House and the Kremlin. And the Soviets weren't, they presumably read and more or less understood some of these very vague and convoluted symbols that were being used to suggest some interest in opening up things with China. But if they knew anything about several of these channels that to the Chinese that were being used, they didn't let on. So these things moved in parallel, but for some reason the Soviets, who had been eager to get out of the doghouse because of Czechoslovakia and also their support of the Vietnamese, kept stalling after an initial indication that they were interested in getting the summit restored. Whether that was a dispute in the Soviet leadership or whatever the reasons may have been, maybe they thought they were doing us a favor and they could extract all kinds of concessions for us. The result of this was that somewhere toward the end of 1969, early 1970, the Chinese channels began to catch up and overtake the Soviet channels to the point where we were still waiting for a Soviet response for a summit when Kissinger went off to China in the summer of 1971 to negotiate the summit meeting between the Chinese leadership and Nixon. When de Brinon, the Soviet ambassador, was informed about Kissinger's impending trip a few hours before it took place, and then when the announcement was made of the trip and the decision on the meeting, he clearly was taken aback, and he remarks on it in a rather sour way in his memoirs, and saying that when Kissinger got back to Washington from China and his on the world trip in San Clemente and so on, he called me and asked me to have dinner, and actually President Nixon showed up because they were trying to butter up the Soviets at this point to show them that we hadn't forgotten them, but we were playing a stronger hand. De Brinon said we talked about everything except about China. And so there was a certain bitterness later. There were more, I guess, briefings, you'd call them, in the contact. But then eventually the Soviets agreed to the summit meeting and so on. Now, this was all good, clean fun, but it was serious. Because the perception in the United States was that we were in deep trouble. And it was a perception that had made its way into the government, and certainly lots of other places, because of these various issues that I mentioned earlier and others mentioned earlier. These two openings, which appeared in early 1972, I don't think Nixon was in any danger of losing the election in 1972, but the timing was not entirely unrelated, I suppose. Maybe the other guys that agreed to having these two grand and highly publicized meetings had in mind helping Nixon to win the election. I doubt it. They had their own fish to fry. Well, in any event, this was the beginning of the famous whatever you want to call it, trilateral relationship, triangular relationship. But it put us in a, at least for a considerable time, in a substantially better, at least tactical position, and as it turned out, strategic position, than we had been in as the Vietnam War had more and more corrosive effects on our on our domestic situation, and made governing more and more difficult. And then, of course, Watergate came along and made it even more difficult. But these two channels had been established, and some substance began to appear in them. And I think it ultimately had something to do, and that we can talk about it later, with what happened to the Soviet Union 20 years later.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank our three panelists for sharing their recollections with us. Though they only had about 10 minutes each, I think that they've already identified some of the major themes. Dick Smizer pointed out that the objective was to try to win Chinese support for some kind of a agreement on military matters in Vietnam, a ceasefire, a conclusion of hostilities that would leave the South Vietnamese government in place. The issue is whether, as we discussed earlier today, whether the vision on the American side was to provide a decent interval thereafter for a decent chance for the South Vietnamese government, free of as much military pressure from the North, to bolster its position, could it reasonably survive. Hal Sonnenfeld has basically told the story, and I believe that the phrase that Henry Kissinger used to describe the strategy to Nixon was to have our vodka and drink our Maokai too. In other words, to be able to use the triangular relationship not as two against one, but one in which the United States would be able to improve its relations with both Moscow and Beijing simultaneously and to enjoy a situation in which we had better relations with both of them than they had with each other. And that obviously raises the question of how long could we play that game. I do want to start just by raising, however, a question for Winston, and I warned him that I would do this. Tell us a little more about how Taiwan was handled in the very first visits. In his memoirs, Henry Kissinger basically makes the case that despite what the China specialists, both inside and outside government, might have said, the Chinese really didn't care that much about Taiwan, and that he was very quickly able to dispose of the issue and to get on to the matters that the Chinese really did care about, which was the overall strategic situation and especially the common threat from the Soviet Union. My reading of the declassified materials is, in fact, quite different, that a lot of time was spent on Taiwan, and that if it was disposed of fairly easily, at least for the time being, it's because Mr. Kissinger, I think correctly, was able to satisfy the Chinese on their major points that they wanted to hear that had been communicated to us very early on. But I wonder if you could give your perspective on how the Taiwan issue was managed, especially given the fact that this was, as I think Hal called it, the third rail in U.S. politics.
I'll get right to that. Just a two-sentence intervention on two issues that you already raised. On the Vietnam issue, we'll come back to that. It was a decent chance, not a decent interval, and I want to make that very clear. We can document that. By the way, the Chinese had an interest, in addition to ones you cited, Dick, to end this war with a military settlement only and encourage Hanoi. Number one, remove an ideological irritant with us. Number two, it would get U.S. troops away from their border. And number three, at a time when they wanted us to balance Moscow, it was not in their interest to see the U.S. humiliated by overthrowing an ally as well as withdrawing our troops. So I think for all these reasons, in addition to the key one that you mentioned, they were moderately helpful, although not decisive. And then on the Soviet Union, I'll just add the point that we gave the Russians every chance to have the first summit. Indeed, I got a call from the Deputy National Security Advisor, Al Haig, at the time, when we were traveling publicly on the way to China secretly, in Thailand, I believe it was, it might have been India, in which Haig in doublespeak over the phone to me, it didn't fool anybody, including the Thai operator, I'm sure. In effect, said that the Ukrainians turned us down on a summit again. And so after that, they had to come second in the summit. But they, even on their way to China, they still could have been first if they had agreed. Correct me if I'm wrong, Hal, but I think we gave them one last chance before we went into China. Now, on your question on Taiwan, as I said, it's always been the most sensitive issue. It includes that today, along with human rights. And we have to get over this being the only item on the agenda before we would agree to going to China. I agree that Henry's account in his first memoirs summarized this both in terms of the importance of the discussion and the length of it in a very brisk fashion. I don't know whether the words to use in a semi-public hearing. So I think there's no question that, and this was written, I guess, in the late 70s, so I guess he could still be excused, it seems to me, for the private assurances and the public rhetoric. It was a very difficult balancing game. So it was important to the Chinese, of course, but important in terms of direction, not solution. So as long as Kissinger could convey, and some of the formulations seemed like they were very forthcoming, and in many ways they were that he used, but they were also subject to gradual implementation in many cases, and it was more a matter of principle. And as we said in our memo to the president getting ready for his trip to China, the Chinese are very insistent on principle, but once you establish that, they can be very flexible within that. So I say, yes, it was important, but it is a fact, once they had this principle and the direction we were headed in, they made many concessions of their own, by the way, we can get into that, including setting up liaison offices in Washington, which are embassies and everything but name, even though the nationalist Chinese still had an embassy, and not insisting on diplomatic relations. So it was mutual concession. But the point is, yes and no. It was important to them, as long as you establish the direction and the principle. But after that,
There was very little discussion of Taiwan in subsequent meetings with the Chinese. It was almost all on the Soviets, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Middle East, Vietnam, South Asia, etc. The final point I'd make is, and I made this point this morning to a smaller group of scholars, that whatever one's view of our concessions, Chinese concessions, I think both sides showed courage in being willing to put this on the side in terms of a modus vivendi that would allow us to get on with our larger concerns. And thanks to the Taiwan people, above all, and some enlightened leadership in Taiwan, six administrations' policies, the Balancing Act on Taiwan and China, have resulted in Taiwan's security being assured, its economy flourishing with some current hiccups, and with a flourishing democracy. And so I would say that whatever the methods used and whatever degree of concessions on either side, again, thanks essentially to the Taiwan people, but also to, I think, a skillful balancing act by Republican and Democratic presidents, Taiwan has done extremely well in the last 30 years.
Let's turn to our audience. They've been listening with rapt attention, and we have both some very distinguished Cold War historians in the audience, as well as some students and general public. So feel free to ask either very specific questions, although I hope they'll be of broad interest, or the so-called ignorant and naive questions, which sometimes raise even more fundamental points. Let's turn to one of the founders of international Cold War history, Jim Hirschberg, for the first question.
Two related questions for all three of you, one of which passed the word began to address before the other two arrived. One is, how important was delivering intelligence to the Chinese about the Soviets, both in your minds, in preparing the opening, and in the actual context? Because in reading the records, one repeatedly sees the Americans offering goodies to the Chinese in terms of intelligence about the Soviets. So I'd be curious to what extent this was important, this succeeded, and how tailored that intelligence was. And the second related question is, how seriously did you take the concern of a large-scale Sino-Soviet war during this period, and specifically a Soviet attack on China and the Chinese nuclear facilities? From some of the memoir accounts that Solomon, one gets the impression that the Americans more or less averted a war. In Kissinger's and others' accounts, there's repeated references to the Soviets constantly seeking a U.S.-Soviet nuclear non-aggression pact that the U.S. interpreted as giving the Soviets a green light to attack China. And of course, there's a very specific crisis of December 71, where when Kissinger meets the Chinese representative of the United Nations, there's a virtual promise that in the event that the Soviets intervene on India's side against Pakistan, and China decides to intervene on Pakistan's side, we would intervene on the side of China, which is a rather mind-boggling proposition to the formal state of relations.
Well, I don't know how much eagerness the Chinese displayed for intelligence. It wouldn't have been like them, I don't think, but we presumably thought that there was an interest and that they were short of it. In fact, the whole scholarly community in China that dealt with Washington affairs and so on, years later, complained about how out of it they were because they didn't have access to publications and so on and so forth. I think it was important to the Chinese, and presumably was something they figured they'd benefit from. They'd never acknowledge it, but and it was a very dicey time for them because of the situation that you were just describing between them and the Soviets. But I would guess that it was fairly well scrubbed, pretty well scrubbed. And they subsequently were of considerable help to us on the intelligence side because of the various devices we were able to place on Chinese soil to keep track of Soviet nuclear and missile testing, underground test, nuclear testing and missile testing. So my hunch is that the exchange may, in the end, have been more or less even Stephen, which was certainly part of the network that we had. What was the second question? The concern about a Sino-Soviet war. I don't know why it's become such a fascinating subject for journalists and historians. As I recall, some of you were watching it every day with great care, and we all agreed that this was not something that we would particularly want to encourage. There were some people who thought it would be great for these two communists to beat each other up. But I think would have judged, and I think the intelligence people for the most part would have said the Soviets would do very well in such a war, and we would very quickly encounter them on the coast, which was not exactly what we were looking for in our relations with the Soviets. But as far as I can tell, maybe there's information that's contrary to this, our most important involvement in all of this was to know what was going on. Whether we would have told the Chinese they're coming over the river tomorrow, I don't know. But we were keenly interested in this because I think we were concerned that it indeed might happen, but there wasn't really anything very much we could do about it. We certainly didn't encourage it.
Yes, two things. First of all, even while we were on the trip, and one of the reasons why we protected this photo album as carefully as we did, was because we were worried that if there was a gap between the time that the Soviets knew that we were in China and the time it was announced, that might be a moment when they felt that they had to move. So we were, I would say, not scared. I think how Sonnenfeld put it right, we were not sitting there in a state of intense alarm, but nonetheless, this was one of the things that was kind of on the back of the book. And one of the things that Joe and I said to us, which I've always wondered about, and I've always wondered about his motivation, was he talked about the Ussuri River incident. And he said, well, you know, when the Soviets did that, they didn't do it because they were concerned about us. They really did it only because they wanted to distract attention from the fact that they were not backing Walter Ulbricht as firmly as they should in his efforts to get a separate peace treaty. Now, I don't think that Khrushchev or whoever was in charge of Brezhnev was that subtle. So I've never quite known why Zhou Enlai said that. But a theory could be that what he was trying to do was to say to us, look, we're not really worried about the Russians. This was a game that they were playing. It had nothing to do with us. However, this is a realm of pure speculation as far as I'm concerned. Maybe somebody has the answer, but I certainly don't have it. Nonetheless, there was, I would say, a kind of nagging worry on our side that the Russians might, stupid as they were, do something if they saw that they had to move.
A couple of points. First, on Russia, I think it should be pointed out, we're talking about payoff of the China opening this morning. My view, and so I think Carol would agree with that.